The Ladies of the Covenant, Memoirs of Distinguished Scottish Female Characters, Embracing the Period of the Covenant and the Persecution, by Reverend James Anderson. Lady Anne Cunningham, Marchioness of Hamilton. Lady Anne Cunningham was the fourth daughter of James, 7th Earl of Glencairn, by his first wife Margaret, second daughter of Sir Colin Campbell of Glenurquhy. Her ancestors, on the father's side, were among the first of the Scottish peers who embraced the Reformed doctrine. In 1640, her great-great-grandfather William, 4th Earl of Glencairn, and her great-grandfather, then Lord Kilmars, afterward 5th Earl of Glencairn, appear among the converts to the Reformed faith. Her great-grandfather in particular, whose piety and benevolence procured him the honorable appellation of the Good Earl, was an ardent and steady promoter of the Reformation, for which he was eminently qualified by his superior learning and abilities, as well as by the influence of his high station. And he carefully instructed his children in its principles. He regularly attended the sermons of John Knox on the Reformers returning to Scotland in 1554, and in 1556 he invited him to administer the sacrament of the Lord's Supper after the manner of the Reformed Church in his baronial mansion of Finlayston in the parish of Kilmalcolm, when he himself, his countess, and two of their sons, with a number of their friends, partook of that solemn ordinance. He also assisted the Reformers by his pen, being the author of a satirical poem upon the Roman Catholic monks entitled An Epistle Direct from the Holy Hermit of Alaret to His Brethren the Grey Friars. Nor did he shrink from drawing the sword for their protection. In 1559, when the Reformers took up arms at Perth to defend themselves from the Queen Regent, who had collected an army and had advanced to Perth to avenge the destruction of the popish images by the populace of that town, he raised 1,200 horse and 1,300 foot in the west, and the passes being occupied, conducted them through the mountains, traveling night and day till they reached Perth, which proved a seasonable aid to the Reformers, and by the consternation with which it inspired the Queen Regent, prevented the effusion of blood. This nobleman often visited Knox on his deathbed, and he died in 1574. Lady Anne's father, James, 7th Earl of Glencairn, was also a friend to the liberties and religion of his country. He was one of those noblemen who, when the Duke of Lennox, an emissary of the court of France, had acquired a complete influence over James VI, soon after his assuming the reins of government, and had effected an entire change in the court, filling it with persons devoted to popery and arbitrary power, resolved to take possession of the king's person, and, removing Lennox and another favorite, the Earl of Arran, from him, to take upon themselves the direction of public affairs. With this view, on meeting with the king returning from hunting in Athol, several of them invited him to Ruthven Castle, where they effected their purpose, and hence this enterprise was called the Raid of Ruthven. Of the early life of Lady Anne we possess no information. In the beginning of the year 1603, she was married to Lord James, the son and heir presumptive of John, 1st Marquess of Hamilton. By her marriage contract, dated the 30th of January, 1603, which received the consent of both their fathers, the marriage portion is 40,000 merks, and the yearly jointure 56 calders of victual, and £500 of money rent. Lady Hamilton inherited from her father's family an ardent zeal for presbytery. During the first part of her life, an almost continued contest existed between James VI and the Church of Scotland in reference to that form of church government. As has been said in the introduction, James commenced that struggle for absolute power, which was resolutely preserved in by his son and his two grandsons. And to reach his purpose, he deemed it necessary to undermine the Presbyterian government of the Church of Scotland. With his usual profanity, he asserted that monarchy and presbytery agreed as well as God and the devil. No assertion could be more unfounded. It cannot indeed be denied that the republicanism of Presbyterian church government is unfriendly to absolute or despotic monarchy. The fundamental principle of presbytery, that spiritual power is lodged exclusively in the church courts, uncontrolled by the civil magistrate, greatly limits the power of monarchs, saying to them when they reach the borders of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, "Hitherto shalt thou come and no farther," and naturally leads men to conclude that, by parity of reason, temporal power should be lodged in a parliament. But that presbytery is hostile to limited monarchy is disproved by the whole of its history in Scotland. For no body of people was ever more devoted to the throne than the Presbyterians. And indeed, they often carried their loyalty to a reprehensible and extravagant excess. It was not, however, a limited but an absolute monarchy on the erection of which James's heart was set. And seeing clearly enough that presbytery was the enemy of such a monarchy, he made every effort to overthrow it, and to introduce prelacy, which he well knew would be a more effectual instrument in advancing his design. These efforts he was not permitted to make without opposition. A body of ministers, respectable for number and still more respectable for their talents, piety, and zeal, resolutely and perseveringly resisted him till the close of his life. They maintained that by attempting to impose upon the church the form of government and mode of worship which were most accordant with his inclinations, and by endeavoring to control her in her administration, he was invading the prerogative of Christ, the sole king and head of the church, who alone had the right to settle the form of her government, and by whose authority alone she was to be guided in her administration. By threats, bribes, imprisonment, and banishment, James labored hard to get them to yield to his wishes. But animated by a high sense of duty, they were not to be overborne, and largely imbued with the spirit of martyrs, they preferred enduring the utmost effects of his royal wrath rather than make the unhallowed surrender. So much importance did they attach to their principles as to deem them worthy even of the sacrifice of their lives. "We have been even waiting with joyfulness," said one of them, "to give the last testimony of our blood in confirmation thereof, if it should please our God to be so favorable as to honor us with that dignity." It is the courage, zeal, and self-sacrifice with which this party contended for the rights and liberties of the Church during the reigns of James VI and Charles I that imparts to this portion of our ecclesiastical history its principal charm. To this party, the Marchioness of Hamilton adhered with great zeal, actuated by sympathy with the principles contended for, as well as by sympathy with the character of the men themselves, who, besides being the most gifted, were the most pious, active, and faithful ministers of the Church of Scotland in their day. Her husband, the Marquis of Hamilton, was not equally steadfast with herself in maintaining the liberties of the Church. Facile and ambitious, he was induced, from a desire to please his sovereign, to become an advocate for conformity to the Five Articles of Perth, and to exert his influence to obtain their ratification in the Scottish Parliament of 1621, where he was His Majesty's High Commissioner. This nobleman was cut off in the prime of his life, having died at London on the 2nd of March, 1625, in the 36th year of his age. Quote, "Small regret," says Calderwood, "was made for his death, for the service he made at the last Parliament." End quote. The Marchioness survived the Marquis many years, during which time she was eminently useful as an encourager of the faithful ministers of the gospel, whom she was ever ready to shield from persecution and to countenance in every way competent to her. When Mr. Robert Boyd of Trockrigg had, a few months after his being admitted minister of Paisley, been driven out of that town by the mob, who showered upon him, quote, "stones and dirt," end quote, Paisley being then, as Rowe describes it, quote, "a nest of papists," end quote, she was earnestly desirous to take that great and good man under her protection, and invited him to accept of the charge of the parish of Cambuslang, which was at that time vacant. Mr. James Bruce, writing to him from Glasgow in October 1626, says, quote, "The parish of Cambuslang is now vacant, and the Lady Marchioness is earnestly desirous to have you there. Her jointure lies there. It is within 3 miles of Glasgow, has a reasonable stipend, besides the lady's pension, which she will rather augment than diminish. You will live easier and at more peace there than at Paisley. You will have the Lady Marchioness's company, which is very desirable. This I leave to your consideration and the Lord's direction." End quote. An end, however, was put to this matter by the growing illness of Boyd, which took him to Edinburgh to consult with physicians, and on reaching the capital his sickness increased till it terminated in his death on the 5th of January, 1627. The name of the Marchioness stands favorably connected with that memorable revival of religion which took place at the Kirk of Shotts on the 21st of June, 1630, the Monday after the celebration of the Lord's Supper. Indeed, that revival may be said to be directly traceable to the piety of this lady, who was forward to embrace every opportunity of bringing within the reach of others the blessed gospel which she herself so highly prized. And it originated in a circumstance apparently incidental, the breaking down of her carriage on the road at Shotts. How important the results for either good or evil to mankind, which, under the government of infinite wisdom, have been produced by the most trivial events. The sight of the spider's web and the pigeon's nest at the entrance of the cave in which Muhammad concealed himself diverted his pursuers from searching it, and saving the life of the false prophet contributed to entail for ages upon a large part of the world the curse of the Muhammadan superstition. And in the Reformation throughout Europe, incidents equally insignificant have, on the other hand, been big with consequences, the most beneficial to mankind. The circumstance of the breaking down of the Marchioness's carriage, seemingly casual as it was, resulted in some hundreds of immortal beings experiencing that blessed change of heart which unites the soul to God and which issues in everlasting salvation. The particulars, insofar as she was concerned, were these. As the road to Edinburgh from the west lay by the Kirk of Shotts, she frequently passed that way in traveling from the place of her residence to the capital, and on such occasions she received, in different instances, civilities from Mr. Home, minister of the parish. At one time, in particular, when, on her passing through Shotts, accompanied with some other ladies, the carriage in which they were riding broke down in the neighborhood of the manse. Mr. Home, on learning the accident, kindly invited them to alight and remain all night in his house, as they were at a considerable distance from any convenient place of entertainment. Having accepted his invitation, they observed, during their stay, that, besides this inconvenient situation, the manse stood much in need of being repaired. and the Marchioness, in return for his attentions, erected for him a new manse in a more agreeable situation and with superior accommodations. On receiving so substantial a favor, Mr. Home waited upon her to express his obligations and desired to know if there was anything he could do by which to testify his gratitude. All she asked was that he would be kind enough to allow her to name the ministers he should have with him as his assistants at the celebration of the Lord's Supper. This request he cordially granted. She accordingly named some of the most distinguished ministers of the day, Mr. Robert Bruce, Mr. David Dixon, and some others, who had been remarkably successful as instruments in bringing many to the saving knowledge of the truth. The report that such celebrated men were to assist at the communion at that place soon circulated extensively through the country, and a vast multitude, attracted by their fame, assembled from all quarters, many of them of eminent piety, among whom were the Marchioness herself and other ladies of rank who attended at her invitation. The solemnity to which she was the means of bringing these ministers and of gathering together so great a crowd of people was accompanied in a very signal manner with the divine blessing. For several days before, much time was spent in social prayer. During all the days of the solemn occasion, the ministers were remarkably assisted. The devout who attended were in a more than ordinary degree refreshed and edified. And so largely was the spirit of grace and supplication poured out upon them that, after being dismissed on the Sabbath, they spent the whole night in different companies in prayer. On the Monday morning, the ministers, understanding how they had been engaged and perceiving them, instead of returning to their homes, still lingering at the place, as if unwilling to depart from a spot which they had found in their experience to be, as it were, the gate of heaven, agreed to have sermon on that day, though it was not usual at that time to preach on the Monday after the dispensation of the Lord's Supper. The minister whose turn it was to officiate having become unwell, the work of addressing the people was, at the suggestion of Lady Culross, laid upon Mr. John Livingston, then a young man and chaplain to the Countess of Wigton. Livingston had before preached at Shotts, and had found more liberty in preaching there than at other places. But from the great multitude of all ranks assembled on that occasion, he became so diffident that, when alone in the fields in the morning, he began to think of stealing away rather than address the people. "But," says he, "I durst not so far distrust God, and so went to sermon and got good assistance. I had about an hour and a half upon the points I had meditated on, Ezekiel 36:25-26, then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean. From all your filthiness and from all your idols will I cleanse you. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh." And in the end, offering to close with some words of exhortation, I was led on about an hour's time in a strain of exhortation and warning with such liberty and melting of heart as I never had the like in public in all my life. And such was the effect that, as Mr. Fleming observes in his Fulfilling of the Scriptures, quote, "Near 500 had at that time a discernible change wrought on them, of whom most proved lively Christians afterward. It was the sowing of a seed through Clydesdale, so as many of the most eminent Christians in that country could date either their conversion or some remarkable confirmation in their case from that day." End quote. After this, the practice of preaching on the Monday following the sacrament became general. The Marchioness of Hamilton was personally known to Mr. John Livingston, and in his memorable characteristics he has given her a place among, quote, some of the professors in the Church of Scotland of his acquaintance who were eminent for grace and gifts, end quote. From his life, we also learn that whatever influence she had with the court at London, she was well inclined to use it for the protection of the persecuted nonconformists. He informs us that after he himself, Mr. Robert Blair, and others of his brethren in Ireland had been deposed in May 1632 by the Bishop of Down, and when Mr. Blair went to London to represent their cause to the government, he himself, who was to follow Mr. Blair, went previously to Scotland with the design of procuring letters from the Lady Marchioness of Hamilton and other persons of rank to some of their friends at court, vindicating him and his brethren from the charge of stirring up the people to ecstasies and enthusiasm, and requesting for them toleration to preach the gospel notwithstanding their nonconformity. During the stirring period when the Scottish people renewed the National Covenant and successfully resisted the attempts of Charles I to impose upon them a book of canons and a liturgy, the Marchioness warmly espoused the cause of the Covenant. Possessed of a strong and masculine spirit, she displayed an undaunted heroism in the cause, which neither the sight of personal danger nor the partiality of maternal affection could subdue. When her son James, Marquis, afterward Duke of Hamilton, who sided with Charles I against the Covenanters, conducted an English fleet to the Forth in 1639 to overawe them, she appeared on horseback with two pistols by her side, at the head of a troop of horse, among the intrepid thousands who lined the shores of Leith on that occasion to resist his landing, and, drawing one of her pistols from her saddle bow, declared she would be the first to shoot him should he presume to land and attack the troops of the Covenant. It is said that she had even loaded her pistols with balls of gold, but this rests on very doubtful authority. It is certain, however, that when the Marquis cast anchor in the Forth, near Leith, loitering for the king, whose army was marching into Scotland to his assistance, she paid him a visit on board his vessel. The particulars of this interview have not been recorded, but the people anticipated from it the most favorable results. Quote, "The son of such a mother," they said, "will do us no harm," end quote. Nor did they suffer any harm. The spirited conduct and intercession of his mother, it is supposed, was one cause which prevented the Marquis's debarkation of his troops. Other causes, however, seem to have contributed to this. The number of his troops, which amounted only to about 3,000 or 4,000, was too small for the occasion. Besides, hearing that a part of the English army, being encountered by the Scots at Kelso, were defeated, with a loss of 300 men, and put to flight, he was not in a disposition to engage with the Covenanters, who gave such decided proofs of earnestness. And soon after, a pacification was concluded between them and the king at the Burghs of Berwick. Respecting this lady, we meet with no additional facts except that her last will is dated the 4th of November, 1644, and that she died in 1647. It may be added that there is a portrait of the Marchioness in Pinkerton's Scottish Gallery of Portraits, Volume 2. Quote, "The portrait," says Pinkerton, "corresponds with the masculine character of the Marchioness." He adds, quote, "Johnson, the ingenious limner, died before he had finished the drapery of this drawing, which is from a painting by Jameson at Taymouth." End quote. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit westportexperiment.com for more audio resources, and where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.